I actually think that this may be the first time in a long career that I've actually asked to speak. I'm sorry to disappoint you. I didn't actually ask to speak at your graduation. It was an expectation. But the passing of Reverend Fryam should not go without discussion. And so I asked for the opportunity to speak a few moments this morning about Reb Fryam. For almost two decades, I benefited from a close relationship with Reb Fryam Greenblatt. We spoke regularly, and we discussed various issues facing Northwest Yeshiva High School. In these many conversations, Reb Fryam shared with me elements of his outlook. These included his perspective on the role of a posek, as well as insight into his personal attitudes and his values. Our sages list a number of negative characteristics that will be pronounced in the generation that will precede the coming of the Messiah. Among these characteristics is one that is completely enigmatic. The face of the generation will be like the face of a dog. Rav Elchanan Wasserman, Zecher Levracha, suggested an interpretation for this mysterious comment. He asks that we envision a person who is walking along a forest path with his dog. We can expect to observe the dog running ahead of his companion. Superficial observation might suggest that the dog is leading his companion and selecting the path that they shall travel together. However, if we observe carefully, we will see that the dog, as he approaches a fork in the road, pauses. He waits for his master to provide some indication of the direction he wishes to take at the fork. Once the dog determines the direction that his master will select, he again runs ahead of the pair. So who is the leader in this pair? The dog travels ahead of the master, but he only follows the path that he anticipates his master will select. The dog may appear to lead, but he is actually the follower. Rav Elchanan suggested that there are two leadership models. The far more common, and the one that will dominate the generation preceding the Mashiach, is a leader who places himself before the people, but is actually a pseudo-leader. Like the dog in our story, he travels in front of his master, but this pseudo-leader studies those that he actually is following. He considers the attitudes and the values of those that he presumes to lead, and actually all he does is run ahead of where he anticipates the crowd is already proceeding. In contrast, the other type of leader, an authentic leader, educates and inspires his followers. He identifies the proper path, and he beckons others to follow him. Rav Fryam was a courageous leader. He spoke the truth, regardless of personal or political consequences. Rav Fryam came to the United States from Israel, and he became a devoted Talmud of the Posek Kador, Rav Moshe Feinstein, Zecher Levracha. Eventually, at Rav Moshe's suggestion, he took a position in Memphis, Tennessee. Early in his tenure in Memphis, he was approached by an influential and a very wealthy gvir of the community. This gentleman explained to Rav Fryam that his son was soon to be engaged to a non-Jewish young lady. She was willing to undergo a conversion ritual, but not committed to changing her lifestyle. So this petitioner, this Gvir, he had already consulted Orthodox rabbis, and they had unanimously refused to convert the young woman. He now demanded that Rabbi Ephraim conduct this conversion. Rabbi Ephraim explained that the same considerations that had informed the response of his colleagues bound him as well, and he would not conduct this sham conversion. The Gvir told Rabbi Ephraim that he should reconsider. He correctly suspected that Rabbi Ephraim's immigration papers were not in order. He told Rabbi Ephraim that if he would not acquiesce to his demands, then he would report him to the immigration authorities. So Rabbi Ephraim refused to yield, and he quickly returned to New York and sought out Rav Moshe's assistance. Rav Moshe introduced Rabbi Ephraim to an attorney who helped him secure proper papers, and with these in hand, he returned to Memphis. As he had threatened, the Gvir did report Rabbi Ephraim, and soon after his return to Memphis, he was visited by immigration authorities. Now, Rabbi Ephraim had a wonderful sense of humor. So with great relish, he described to me his deep satisfaction in presenting his brand new papers to the officials and sending them on their way. Taking advantage of Rabbi Ephraim's fondness for the humorous aspects of the human condition, I responded that as an American, I was shocked by his account. How could he, a former terrorist, so easily secured refuge in the United States? Let me explain. As a teenager growing up in Eretz Yisrael, under the mandate authority of the British government, Rabbi Ephraim had indeed been a terrorist. He was a member of Irgun, and he fought against the British occupation of Eretz Israel. And not only was he a member of Irgun, but he was one of Irgun's bomb makers. In his later years, Rabbi Ephraim published two brief works on the weekly parasha. In the introduction to one of these, he explores the concept of Hasid Shote. The Talmud uses this term to describe a person who, guided by exaggerated false piety, dismisses real and urgent imperatives. In an example provided by the Gemara, this Hasid Shote refuses to rescue a drowning young woman, lest he compromise himself by gazing upon a portion of the woman normally covered. Rabbi Ephraim suggested more contemporary examples of the Hasid Shoteh. He noted that Israel's Haredi establishment had opposed the creation of the Hesder Yeshiva system. This program allows young men to combine service in the IDF with studies in yeshiva. The Haredi establishment regarded the system as tainted by its Zionistic values. The Haredi system also felt that the Hesder system would compete with it and perhaps undermine its more authentic values. Rabbi Ephraim observed that countless young men had received an advanced yeshiva education through the Hesder system. These young men had in turn married, created their own families, and raised their own children as observant Jews. How many of these young men would have been lost to Torah observance were it not for the Hesder system? Similarly, Rabbi Ephraim writes that he recalls the opposition of many members of the Orthodox establishment in the United States to the innovation of the modern Orthodox day school. These leaders felt that the emphasis that these programs placed upon secular studies would undermine commitment to Torah learning. Ephraim remarked that without our day schools, our contemporary Orthodox community would be only a fraction of its current size. He proudly noted that young people who are the products of our day schools are among our community's leaders and are committed supporters of Orthodoxy throughout the United States and Israel. When I read these comments, I was surprised that Rabbi Ephraim was willing to so harshly criticize positions championed by respected leaders of the Orthodox and Haredi establishment. He responded to me that he was an old man and that he had earned the right to speak his mind, and therefore it was his responsibility to exercise that right. There are different reasons why a head of school like myself consults with a posek. Sometimes I called Rabbi Ephraim because I truly had no idea how to resolve an issue. But honestly, at other times, I had a fairly clear idea of the solution to my dilemma. However, I sought Rabbi Ephraim's in order to take advantage of his very broad shoulders. In these instances, I was faced with a challenge of implementing a policy that I knew would be controversial. I needed Rabbi Ephraim's endorsement of my position. On every occasion, he shared freely with me his views. He instructed me, and he told me that I should readily quote his position. He believed that it was his duty as a posek to offer guidance and to take full responsibility for his positions. He believed that it is a rav's sacred duty to speak the truth and promote Torah. Once, he was contacted by a day school principal who had been invited to a bat mitzvah that would take place on Shabbat and Mincha. As part of the bat mitzvah celebration, the young lady would be reading the Shabbat Mincha Torah portion. He explained to Rabbi Ephraim that the bat mitzvah's mother was the president of his school, and that he would, for sure, compromise his position of head of school by refusing to attend. Rabbi Ephraim urged him to explain to the bat mitzvah's mother that he only attended services at Orthodox synagogues and regretfully could not be present for the bat mitzvah. The head of school explained to Rabbi Ephraim that his problem was that the bat mitzvah was being conducted at an Orthodox synagogue. It was this circumstance that complicated the situation. How could he refuse to attend this bat mitzvah based upon his practice as an Orthodox rabbi when the celebration was being held at an Orthodox shul? Rabbi Ephraim offered to speak to the shul's rabbi, who he did not know, and to try to persuade him to design a more acceptable bat mitzvah celebration that would conform to Torah practice. So, Rabbi Ephraim called the shul's rabbi. The rabbi explained that the shul would daven mincha on that Shabbat like it did every other Shabbat in the main sanctuary. On the other hand, the family of the bat mitzvah had rented a smaller Beit Midrash, and there the family would conduct the bat mitzvah as it saw fit. The service would be conducted not under the auspices of the synagogue or with the certification of the rabbi. It would be completely a private event. Rabbi Ephraim protested. He told the rabbi that it was his responsibility to supervise all events at his shul, and that he could not abdicate that duty by treating this bat mitzvah as a private event. The rabbi responded in a somewhat condescending manner that he had served the congregation for many years. He attributed the length of his tenure to his talent for designing innovative compromises like this one. Rabbi Ephraim responded. He told the rabbi, in order to design compromises like that one, you never needed to earn your smicha. However, really, Rabbi Ephraim was a pragmatist, and he believed that the posek must be pragmatic. He attributed this outlook to his Rebbe, Rav Moshe, and he first communicated his outlook on pragmatism in Psak Halacha through recounting a difficult discussion that he had with Rav Moshe. As I mentioned, Rav Moshe sent Rav Ephraim to his position in Memphis. In his early days in Memphis, when Rav Ephraim was presented with a difficult question, he would reflexively consult his Rebbe. However, Rav Moshe became progressively more resistant to responding to Rav Ephraim's questions. And eventually, he refused to advise Rav Ephraim, and he insisted that he make his own decisions. Rav Ephraim's entreaties to Rav Moshe to guide him were ignored, and a tension developed between Rav Ephraim and his beloved Rebbe. Rav Ephraim insisted that Rav Moshe explain to him his motives for refusing to advise him, and Rav Moshe curtly responded, "The Torah is not the same in Memphis as it is on the Lower East Side of Manhattan." Rav Ephraim was even more befuddled upon receiving this explanation, but Rav Moshe went on and he explained. He asked Rav Ephraim to imagine that a principal from Brooklyn comes to him, to Rav Moshe, with a question regarding the treatment of his students. Rav Moshe said, "I give the principal my response, which he duly implements. The father of the student is appalled and decides to remove his son from the school. What will happen to that young man? Within a few days or so, the father will enroll him in a different yeshiva, which he believes is more to his liking. Now, let's consider the same situation in Memphis. If the father is upset with your decision and the day school's implementation of your decision, and he removes his son from the day school, there is no other yeshiva. The father will then enroll this young man in public school, and he will be lost to Torah education." Rav Moshe explained to Rabbi Ephraim that a posek must take into account the likely outcomes of his piskei halacha. Yes, he must always work within the framework of halacha, but he must use his knowledge of the circumstances and his mastery of halacha to decide when to be stringent and when to seek a more lenient but authentic solution. Rav Ephraim, from his vantage point in Memphis, must make those decisions that are appropriate for his community. Let me close with one final recollection. Many of my comments reflect Rav Ephraim's deep commitment to chinuch in general and day school education specifically. On the issue of whether a student may be denied such an education, Rav Ephraim was consistently uncompromising. A family joined our community. The family lived in the suburb of Seattle and had been active members in the Messianic Jewish Church. The mother was Jewish by birth, and halachically, the two daughters were Jewish. However, these two young ladies were raised believing in Jesus as their Savior, and they were regular church goers. In fact, I discovered that their home was located directly opposite of the Messianic Church. The parents decided to return to conventional Judaism. They wished to enroll their older daughter in our yeshiva high school and the younger daughter in the Seattle Hebrew Academy. I interviewed the older sister. She looked non-Jewish. She had no idea even of how to dress, for an interview with a rabbi who's head of a yeshiva. I'll leave it at that. She was shy, probably intimidated, no doubt confused, and maybe not too sophisticated in her religious thinking. At the end of the interview, I could not determine what were her religious views. This was a nightmare. On the one hand, I am not comfortable with turning away a family that is seeking to return to Torah Judaism. On the other hand, I had to be honest with myself. Would I want my children to be in school with this young person? How would I respond if this young girl invited my daughter to her home? Is not one of the reasons that we send our children to Jewish schools because we want them to be in an uncompromisingly Jewish community? How could this young person be included in such a community? How would my other parents react when they learned that we were accepting students who only a few weeks ago had been attending church regularly? So I called Rabbi Ephraim and presented him with my dilemma. Rabbi Ephraim responded that I had no right to refuse the young lady admission. I could place her on as strict a probation as I pleased. I could establish any reasonable expectations, but she must be admitted. Let me close by returning to my opening comments. With his passing, I expect that various movements within the Orthodox community will claim that Rebbe Ephraim was one of their own. The Haredi community will point to his deep respect and close relationship for Rav Shach, Zecher Livracha. The modern Orthodox community will know his support for the day school movement. The Dati Lumi movement will note his early association with Irgun. Those opposed to the Zionist movement will note that Rebbe Ephraim personally did not say Hallel and Yom HaTzmut, in fact, he said Tachanun. In truth, he was not a member of any movement. He was not a leader who follows the crowd, leading where it wishes to proceed. He was a courageous leader. He made each decision based on his understanding of the issues and not out of identification with any movement and its agenda. For close to two decades, I spoke with Rabbi Ephraim regularly. We never met in person until a little over a year ago. He always made himself available. He was patient. He was friendly. He gave his time freely. He always made me feel welcome. He had a wonderful sense of humor. He was a teacher. He was a role model. He was a personal friend. And he will be missed deeply. And I very much appreciate this opportunity to share a few thoughts about this truly remarkable individual. Thank you. Yes, that's it.